Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. I'm Morris Ardwin, co-host for the podcast Queer Voices of the South, which is found under the LGBTQ plus studies on the New Books Network right here. Today, I'm talking with Shelby Criswell about their just-released book, Queer as All Get Out, 10 People Who've Inspired Me, which was just released from Street Noise Books. Welcome to the podcast, Shelby.
Thank you so much. I'm really stoked to be here.
Well, we're delighted that you said yes to do this. I know there's a lot going on. The book is just out like this week or next week.
So, yeah, on Tuesday.
Oh, cool. So congratulations.
A week from now.
Congratulations. I know what that feels like. it's such a wonderful feeling, and you've done a beautiful job. So we're going to talk about that beautiful job tonight.
Awesome. Thank you.
I'm going to tell the listeners a little bit about you. Shelby Criswell is a queer comic creator and graphic designer thriving in San Antonio, Texas. Shelby, who uses the pronouns they, there, studied studio arts at the Santa Fe Institute of Art and Design, as well as, the Santa Fe Institute of Art and Design, as well as illustration at the Academy of Arts University. They have been creating comics and drawing since childhood and haven't found anything more fulfilling to take its place. When Shelby is not creating comics or working on graphic design projects for clients, they are playing banjo, going on overnight bike trips, or drinking far too much coffee. I know the drill. Shelby has had work in a few comic anthologies, including Sweaty Palms, Everything is Going Wrong, and is in the Ignatz and Ringo Award-winning book, Be Gay, Do Comics. Shelby made their debut into mainstream comics as the artist on Terminal Punks, published by Mad Cave Studios. Their first graphic novel, Queer as All Get Out, is out now from Street Noise Books. They have also illustrated online comics for Joy Sex Toy and The Nib. Here's a little bit about the book. Follow the daily life of one queer artist from Texas as they introduce us to the lives of 10 extraordinary people. The author shares their life as a genderqueer person living in the American South, revealing their own personal struggle for acceptance and how they were inspired by these historical LGBTQA people to live their own truth. Featuring biographies of Mary Jones, Wei Hua, Magnus Hirschfeld, Dr. Pauli Murray, Wilmer Littleaxe, M. Broadnax, Sister Rosetta Tharpe, Carla Brown, Nancy Cardenas, Ifti Nassim, and Simon Nicolai. I have a few questions, so we're going to go right into them. Again, welcome. You start off telling us in your book about yourself as a genderqueer person in the South. Set that up for us, because it was a great way to get into the book. Tell us a little about your history.
So, yeah, I've always lived in the South. I mean, I was born in San Antonio, Texas, and that's where I live today. And then, I mean, made my way a little bit southwest to New Mexico, but still the South, kind of, you know? And then I've also lived in Tennessee, so I've always been here, and that's been most of my lived experience. And growing up, I lived in this really small little town outside of San Antonio that was a little bit in the country, and you know how it goes, a country school, there's a bunch of, you know, people who are not open to weirdos like me. And I've always been, you know, when I was a kid, I obviously identified as a girl and I was the tomboy of the group, you know. And so that kind of led into my adulthood of, you know, exploring my gender, being genderqueer. And so I discussed that in the beginning of the book.
Yeah, it was a great way a little bit to get to know you, because your individual struggle is unfortunately not unique to those of us who grew up in the South. I grew up in Louisiana. And the culture shifts from region to region in the country, but it happens every single place. I want to tell you, when I moved from New Orleans to New York, I thought, oh, New York is going to be so open and welcoming. Well, I tell you, I was walking with a gay friend in the East Village of New York, one of my first months in the city, and we were just walking, and we got queer bashed verbally on the sidewalk. People yelling, this guy was yelling at us, and we're like, wow. This never happened in New Orleans. So it just depends on where you are and what the circumstance and what kind of crazy person at that time you happen to run into. So So we've all been through some things. You've been through a lot. I know, and your book reveals so much about you as you reveal about these 10 remarkable people. Tell us what made you, I know you're working as an illustrator. Tell us what made you want to write a book about it, about this.
So I actually started off doing comics for The Nib, which is like a online political and satire commentary sort of comic website. And I pitched to them doing something about Magnus Hirschfeld because I had been researching like queer pioneers. And I was like, and I've always been interested in history and like my family genealogy. And so I'm always researching just new people and like collecting stories. And so I pitched to them doing a small bit about Magnus Hirschfeld, and they bit, and so I did it. and that sort of just led into this book being made, because of that was online. I got an agent, and the agent said, hey, let's make this into a bigger thing. And here we are now.
Wonderful. Wonderful. That definitely deserves a bigger thing. well, again, congratulations. There's so many wonderful people. I'm going to ask you to talk about them shortly, but I want to talk a little bit more about the process. For me, when I hear the term illustration, I think of it as both a noun and a verb. Something illustrates a problem. You illustrate. You solve a problem by illustrating it. You begin to solve a problem by illustrating it, or call attention to a problem. Or the illustration itself, it's a something, whatever medium you use, it's a thing too. So it's a noun and a verb. But the process of what you're doing, tell us about how the drawing process itself, when you get into it and you're drawing a panel for something as complex as the many, many panels you do so beautifully in this book, tell us how you, because I'm marveling when I'm looking at this book, I'm like, it stops you. And it's not just the words, because the words are wonderful, but to look at these panels and examine them, like there's so much art in here. There's so much talent that's oozing out of whoever did this. And it's just brilliant. Tell us about the process.
Well, thank you also for all the nice compliments. it's interesting that you said illustrating the problem, and that's a lot of what I do. And in comics specifically, it's you have to kind of know how to draw everything, unfortunately. You know, I've had to, for my Terminal Punks project, learn how to draw animals for the first time. And even with all these 10 people, you have to learn how to draw 10 different people and make it look like them. And even some of the people, like Mary Jones, there's only one image of her, and it's not even an actual photograph. It's a drawing of her that was printed in a newspaper. So the problem becomes, okay, what did she look like? What did she wear during the 1800s, you know? What did New York at the time look like? And so you have to do all this research for all these little details, and then you have to do it 10 times for every single person.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a lot of work.
Yeah, but you did it. I noticed this when I was looking at it. I forget which one of the people I was reading, but I looked at every single face, and you had to put them in all kinds of expressions, but they always looked authentic, like themselves, that you weren't just randomly, good. You studied these people's faces, even though Mary Jones, you only had a little bit to go on. They were all very consistent and believable. I mean, you're very good with getting the expressions in the eyes and the mouths of these illustrations. It's not, these are not cartoons. I mean, it's illustration is, you know, I love comics. I love cartoons, actually. I love animation, all that world. There's so much work that goes into that kind of work. I just marvel at it. So congratulations, and I'm jealous of you having a career in that. That's wonderful.
Thank you.
What happens when you're stuck though? I mean, Mary Jones might be a good example. What happens when you're stuck of something and you've got to fill the panel with more than just one thought? So you want to get, you know, flesh it out.
So a lot of, especially with Mary's, what helped me was just sort of looking up what photographs did exist of like the spaces in New York, and, you know, watching movies or documentaries that have to do with each of these people's, what time period these people lived in, just to sort of inform, like, just little things in the background, like, this is what a roof looked like in 1873, you know? And so I think just collect, and I have these folders just full of pictures, like reference images, and a lot of them I actually sort of drew in the background and kind of copied. So yeah, having a catalog of all these things helped when I felt a little bit stuck. And even in, like, in the parts where I'm drawing myself in San Antonio, luckily there's tons of photos in San Antonio, and I could just drive down the street and go find where that thing was, you know?
Yeah.
So it was easier in that portion to sort of visualize each space.
Well, it comes across, and I'll tell you again, I really appreciate it as a reader, that there had to be so much depth to making these illustrations. These people are so remote in the minds of a lot of people. I think most of them will be unknowns to most people. I did know of Sister Rosetta Tharpe because she's cracked through the internet world, and you see there's some YouTube of her. But the other ones I actually had never heard of, and I was so appreciative that you brought these people to light, especially in context with your own experience, but also as historical figures unto themselves without regard to their gender identity. They're just fascinating. They're all fascinating. So you have great taste in picking subjects. Let's start with Nancy Cardenas. Who was she?
She was a lesbian, a Mexican poet. She was a translator, a playwright, an activist. She did a lot in her life. And she organized one of the earliest pride parades in Mexico, I think in the 70s. And she also is allegedly the first Mexican person in all of Mexico to publicly come out about her sexuality. And she did it on live television, which is good for her. Very bold.
So cool. Yeah.
She was a lot of fun to draw. And I figured, San Antonio is a city sort of full of like Mexican culture, and that inspired me to put her at the forefront of the book, because I felt like a lot of my friends here in San Antonio would appreciate knowing, hey, there's this amazing Mexican lesbian woman who, you know, came before us. And I with all these people, I kind of want my friends and people I know and people I don't know to see themselves, and that's why I chose such a wide array of people.
And you talk a little bit about what each person, how they inspired you, or moved you, or helped inform who you are. Let's talk about the next one in the book is Ifti Nassim. I'm guessing I'm pronouncing that messy, but
I think that might be right. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
I a lot of these people, I had to look it up on YouTube and see if I could find anybody pronouncing their name.
Oh yeah.
Because, you know, reading it is different.
Yeah.
So Ifti was a gay man from Pakistan who was a poet, and he immigrated to America and to escape religious persecution and an arranged marriage to a woman. He, you know, I'll let you read the book, whoever's listening, to, you know, see how he conned his dad into doing that. But he, in Chicago, he started Sangat. It's Sangat. I don't know if it's pronounced all the way. Sangat Chicago. and it was an organization that supported South Asian queer and trans people. And he lives there the rest of his life with his partner, and just wrote poetry. And one of his books was supposedly the first open expression of queer themes in the Urdu language, which is very interesting. And I think a lot of it, that book was banned in a lot of countries that spoke, in a lot of Middle Eastern countries and South Asian countries.
So inspirational. I get lost in these stories. Sorry. Sister no, Rosetta fine. Sister Rosetta Tharpe, I mentioned her because she does have popularity. She's not as obscure as everyone else. But tell us about her. She was amazing just to listen to. I didn't know much about her.
Oh, and she was gorgeous. All of her outfits are beautiful. She was the person who I drew to pitch the book, and she was so much fun to draw because I love drawing guitars. And she has this white puffy coat that she wears in this, and you can look it up on YouTube. It's her performing at like a train yard, and it's so gorgeous. It was so much fun to draw. So going back to her history, she is a Black singer, songwriter, guitar player who she's famous for using like heavy distortion and electric guitars, and it made her the godmother of rock and roll. And she preceded people like Elvis and Little Richard, who, you know, we think of as rock icons and people who made the genre. But in reality, it was mostly Black women, like Sister Rosetta Tharpe. And so obviously that's why she's, you know, well known. And she was in the, I think in 2018, I believe, they inducted her into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But what a lot of people don't know about her is that although she was married to men most of her life, she also spent time with women, and her friends recently in a book said, we caught her a few times with women, but she never publicly came out as bisexual, probably because she was within like the gospel community, you know?
Yeah. Can't do that.
Right.
So she was inspirational. It's like you said, Elvis Presley and Little Richard, Little Richard in particular, so flamboyant and amazing, and he gender bending, you know, and didn't care, and that's why they were so. Elvis wasn't gender bending, but he was genre bending. He did appropriate. His music was something that I think he appreciated hearing those influences, like Rosetta Tharpe. So there's nothing against Elvis that, you know, he didn't create, he didn't originate things, but so he had the good sense to know what to do with it, with the work that people before him had done. So. Good for them all. If you have anything more to talk about her, I'd love to hear it. If not, we'll move on to the next one.
Oh, I think that's about it. I'll let everybody read the book and see how gorgeous she is.
The next one is Weihua. Or Weihua.
Weihua. I think there was actually recently on Google. I was scrolling. And the Google homepage was an illustration of Weihua, which was very cool. Wow. And there was like this interactive thing where you got to weave through sticks and make like a tapestry, which is what Weihua did in their tribe. They are I'm sure I'm going to pronounce this word wrong, Lahamana, or technically like a third gender within the Zuni tribe in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. Modern day, we call Two-Spirit, and they lived in the 1800s, and they served as an ambassador to work with the Smithsonian to document art and history of their tribe. And yeah, that's what a lot of their work was tapestries and pottery. And they were born as male, but identified as a woman, and sort of took on traits of both throughout their life. And that's sort of what the Two-Spirit person does within this tribe. It serves as like a mediator. So that's what they did. And when they died, they buried Weihua, and they buried them in male clothes, but had this sort of, I think, a traditionally cotton thing. I can't remember what it's called. But it's like a cotton thing that goes around your ankles, and it's traditionally what women wore, so that even when they died, they honored them in that way, because it's part of this, part of their tradition. And so the reason why I chose Wewa to be in this book is to show people that, you know, there are other, especially Americans, you know, we're all, it's sort of the they, them, genderqueer thing is kind of new here, but there are other traditions and countries and people way well before us who have had third genders, and people who live outside of a two gender binary.
Yeah. And those cultures, like the Native American cultures, didn't necessarily ostracize, in fact, embrace them and gave them that beautiful term, Two-Spirit. The first time I came across that years ago, it just gave me chills. That is so beautiful.
You grow up and you think, oh, it's just male and female. And then you know, even just researching Wewa, I was like, oh, wow, this country does this, and these people do this. And, you know, it's this long line of people who you never really even known, because of, you know, our textbooks don't let us know, especially here in the South. The Texas textbooks are horrible.
Yeah, it's a shame. And we can get into a lot about what's going on in Texas, but that will take us off course.
That'll be 2 hours.
Talk about, and I used to hear, said the word shame in Texas, such a natural combination. And I'm not, nothing personal about your home state, because I come from a state that's just as funky.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But, I think when you're from the South, you got to know that, you know, some stuff is messed up here.
Yeah. There's some wonderful things, too, about all places.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
Yeah. Mary Jones, you mentioned her earlier, but tell us about Mary Jones.
So Mary Jones, not to be confused with Mother Jones, who has the same name. Mary was a Black trans woman and a sex worker who lived in New York primarily, and also worked in New Orleans sometimes. She is one of the earliest recorded transgender Americans, and it's only because she went to trial for sex work and theft of wallets. She would steal men's wallets, you know, good for her.
Yeah, she's crafty.
Yeah, yeah, good for her. You got to make a living somehow.
Yeah.
But the only reason why we know we have a record of her is because of those court trials, which is very common with a lot of Black people during this time period. A lot of them we only know because of arrests, and not because of any other reason. You know, a lot of them just came out of slavery and their family history was sort of wiped. And even in genealogy, there's this sort of brick wall that a lot of Black people face that they can't, even professional genealogists can't penetrate that brick wall and even know where they came from before they came to America. So but unfortunately, that has carried on even past slavery in Mary Jones's case.
Like everyone so far, and in fact, the whole list, everyone has already passed on. So these people have all done their wonderful contributions to the world we live in now, and have gone. And there are so many people inspired, like we talked about Sister Rosetta. The next one, Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld. I may have come across that name before in other readings. So I said it was Sister Tharp who was the only one, but I think he also made a broader name for himself. Tell us about him.
Yeah, a lot of people probably have heard that name, or at least have seen the film The Danish Girl, which is about one of his patients. So he was a gay Jewish physician and sexologist who opened a nonprofit institute in Germany that catered to helping people explore their sex and their gender. And, you know, they provided free classes. They provided, you know, safe sex tips. And they also helped people with gender confirmation surgeries. And his team was one of the earliest people to do so in the case of The Danish Girl. I think Lily Elby is the name of the woman they first performed on. And sadly, because he was Jewish and he was in Germany and he lived during the time of World War II, he was targeted by the Nazis. And all of the work that he did in his sexology institute, they had like over 20,000 books in their archive and most of it's gone. The Nazis burnt it. And there's, you know, that famous picture of a Nazi youth tossing books into a large fire. And that's where that comes from.
Yeah.
And yeah.
It's so sad.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit more about him. He did have lovers. He did not leave a double life, or maybe I'm remembering that wrong, but he wasn't trying to pass. He just was doing his research. A lot of people tried to pass, let's use that term, because they were not quite able to be in whatever was assigned to them at birth. So he was comfortable already in living a life, especially in those times, that had to be lived in the shadows. Didn't bother him.
Not at all.
Yeah.
No. He also lived in Berlin, which at the time apparently had a pretty prominent like scene of gay people, and even had like drag shows or what they would have considered drag shows at the time, and he was immersed in that culture, and that's where he, you know, him and his friends hung out and talked to people, and you know would ask about their gender and their sexuality, and he also was polyamorous, so he had two partners, and one of them was much younger than him, and one of them was a little bit closer to his age, and he was with them until they died, both of them.
So he was quite a boundary breaker. You said polyamorous and age differences, and he was living fully. And even though he was in horrible times, and to see all of his wonderful work burned, he was a trailblazer. Mm-hmm. Who was Carlette Brown?
Carlette. she was a Black intersex veteran and trans woman who all her life sought gender confirmation surgery. Because she had seen another American white veteran do the same. And she constantly researched how to do it, how to get there, try to, you know, contact the same doctor. And it's unknown if she ever received it. She at one point couldn't get a passport or whatever you need to go across seas because she owed money to the IRS. And it just was like a bunch of things in her life that kept piling up that she just wasn't able to get it. And so that's why it's not known if she ever received it. And I even searched like death certificates or anything I could find on her. I couldn't find anything about the end of her life or when she died, and nobody knows. And so, but if she did go to Europe and get that surgery, she would have been one of the earliest or the first Black transgender American to get a gender confirmation surgery.
Mm. She had some struggle. She had to work. She went to work to try to pay the debt so she could go. And like you said, you revealed that you weren't able to get much beyond that information. And she still has enough in her history to have inspired you. So tell us how she inspired you.
So the person she is inspired by, I'm forgetting her name. It was during the 1940s, I believe. It was a white transgender woman who got that surgery. I can't remember her name, but so many people talk about her when they're talking about queer history. And then when I was researching maybe some of the first trans recorded people in America, I came across Carlette. And also the only reason why we know about Carlette is because somebody in Jet magazine published articles about her because they were interested in her life. And there's an archive online called the Transgender Digital Archive or something like that, that you can go and read all of these articles, these newspaper things, and there's pictures of her about her, and they talk about her struggles, and at one point those articles just sort of stop, and that's maybe when the wall that we all face when trying to find the end of her life.
Yeah.
But the reason why I chose her is because the person she was inspired by was a white woman. And a lot of people know about her, but nobody really knows about Carlette. Maybe because the end of her life is unknown. That's probably why we don't talk about it as much.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned a resource that you provide in the book. You provide several resources. So the listeners out there know that when you're reading this, there's so much great, great information. Work is so comprehensive and thorough that you think it's just going to be a story about 10 people and you know, your title and how they inspired you. But there's a whole lot more. This is a help book. Because you do provide so many great resources. And I love the little asides you have in almost every chapter. You have an aside that takes you out of that story a little bit, and you pull a little bit of context from your own voice, and you draw yourself saying that. And it's really cool. And so I love that. This is a book that moves in so many ways, and I think it's going to have a very lasting value to the LGBTQ+ world, but also beyond that world. There's a lot of information that I think people who are not part of this community are going to go, wow, had no idea how deep this goes. I think so. Thank you for that. The world owes you. Dr. Pauli Murray.
So Dr. Pauli Murray was a Black human rights activist and a lawyer and a scholar and a priest and an author, much like Nancy, that you kind of a jack of all trades. And they explored their gender identity early on in their life. And on the website about Dr. Pauli Murray, like the official website about them, they use he, him, or they, them early on in Pauli's life. And then once they shift later in their life, they change to she and her because that's what Pauli did. Pauli, you know, in early in life, even went to a doctor at one point and said, "Can you give me testosterone?" And the doctor denied them. Because of the times, that was unheard of. And then maybe, you know, later on in their life, they became one of the first Black non-cis gender males to be ordained as an Episcopal priest. And that's probably why they went with a she, her identity, maybe just because of the environment they were surrounded in. But with their work as a lawyer, they wrote books that helped inform the NAACP's argument in the Brown versus a Board of Education case, which is incredible. I did not know that at all. And then I was researching, and I was like, holy crap.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. You informed me in this book. You informed me about a lot of things. Wilmer Little Axe Broadnax. Who was that?
So Wilmer was a Black trans man. And he sang tenor in a lot of famous gospel quartets during the like golden age of traditional Black gospel. And they sang with their brother in most of these quartets, who sang baritone. So, and they also had a significant height difference, which is the funny part. And, you know, the short one sings tenor, sings high, and then the tall one sings low. So they made a good pair, and their brother always kept their secret of being a trans man sacred and never told anybody all their life. And so they lived in this world of surrounded by religious people as a man, and they passed all their life, which is fantastic. Good for them. But when they died, unfortunately, that's when it was found out, and it sort of sent shockwaves throughout that community. And those people sort of felt lied to, but you know, that's a whole other situation.
but they have had achieved a good measure of fame, and I think that's as musicians. Mm-hmm. So I think that's kind of peculiar in many ways that they became successful. A lot of these other people struggled. Not just a thought, but a lot of people struggled financially. And yet Wilmer and their brother were quite successful.
Oh, yeah. They were pretty famous within that community. And I think, unfortunately, some of the recordings were lost in a fire of the record company in like 2008 or something, like this famous fire. But wow. I mean, the things that we do have, they're phenomenal. I have a podcast. I mean, a playlist on Spotify that it's like the official Queers I'll Get Out playlist. And a lot of the groups that he sang in, I have on there.
Wow. I could go check it out. One more of the 10, Simon Nicolai.
Okay, Simon, last but not least, and he's also the last in the book. he was a Black and gay activist who grew up during apartheid in South Africa. So he experienced a lot of racism because of the separation of white and Black people in South Africa. And that informed a lot of what he did. So he constantly was being ridiculed for being against apartheid by his white gay friends. And he sought after making spaces that were safe for both white and Black gay men. But, you know, because of the times and the culture surrounding it, a lot of the white friends were not willing to budge. And so because of that, Simon started the earliest Black gay support group, and also like one of the first pride parades in Johannesburg. And later in his life, he worked as an AIDS activist. But sadly, that's also what killed him in the end. And his friends made this, I think there's a documentary called Simon and I from one of his best friends who is a lesbian woman. And in the end, you can see parts of his actual funeral and the celebration they give to him. And it's a beautiful, beautiful ceremony. And he has a street named after him in Johannesburg. And his story I left last in my book because I dedicated the whole book to my uncle who also died of AIDS.
Yeah, I saw that was very touching. And I opened it up, the book, and you see that. It's such a moving, just little piece of you sharing with us. And a lot of families have uncles like that, especially coming mm-hmm. from the time period of yours, who were going through a lot of things when a lot of things were mysterious still.
Yeah.
About how treatment worked and best practices and all kinds of things, and the ostracized nature of people who were ostracizing nature of people who mm-hmm. Did not know what to do about their relatives, who often were like, had to go basically move away, live a life that's not going to be connected to the family anymore. So when I saw that, it brought me back. I had friends who experienced that because I grew up in the 1970s. I've been around a while. So when the AIDS crisis hit in the 80s, in the late 80s, all of that, no medicine, no the hospitals, the medical community, there was no information. It was just a bunch of chaos. And while the chaos was happening, the misinformation, the disinformation, the bigotry, all happening at once, people were dying. And it's just very touching that you dedicate that to your uncle. So very sweet.
Thank you. Yeah, it's heartbreaking. I even posted one time about him. His name was Doug, and it was wild to me to see how many other people were in the same situation, that they had an uncle that the family doesn't talk about very much who died the same way. And I felt like that was a good way to, this book was a good way to sort of pay tribute to him.
Well done. I'm sure he's smiling down on you. And rightly so. You mentioned throughout, as you introduce a new person, sometimes they go by he or she pronoun, and some others use the they/their construct. I want to talk about that in general because it's definitely something that your book brings up right in the forefront. That this is something that is, it's kind of a moving target these days, where it hasn't been ironed out completely about how best There isn't a great example out there of how do you do this? How do you add a new system of pronouning people, which has been stagnant for all these eons, and you yourself having to live in a world where people don't get that the they is followed by the verb are and not is, even though you're an individual they. Mm-hmm. So that some of those old grammatical constructs that get in the way of people's brains of making this smooth. So tell us about what that's like.
It is funny whenever you mention whenever I mention pronouns to somebody, they immediately become an English teacher. You know, oh, that's the wrong way to do it. Yada yada. But the thing is, like, you know, even in Shakespeare's time, Shakespeare used they them as a reference to one person, and even now we use they them for one person without even thinking about it. So here's an example that I use when trying to explain they them pronouns. And so, say somebody forgot their jacket, and you're trying to tell somebody who works at the restaurant or whatever that the person left their jacket. You say, they left their jacket, here it is, you know. So yeah. You don't know the person's gender, and you automatically use they. You know, you're not going to say, he or she left her jacket, you know.
Right, that would be odd, yes.
Exactly. Yeah, that would be weird. So, yeah, I mean, we all use it, and it is obviously a new thing. Even I had to get used to it at one point. But I picked up pretty quickly because that helped inform my own identity. And that's also why, you know, like I said, wanted to mention people like Wiwa who live in a society where that's normal. I mean, it's normal in other places, so why can't it be normal here?
Exactly. Well done broaching it, because the book does, and it's not consistent from person to person. It's an individual thing, and you make that mm-hmm. very plain by how some of the people felt they should identify themselves. So beautifully done. I wanted to talk, it leads me to the thought about dead naming. Mary Jones, you mentioned that there was a lot of information lost on her because the U.S. Census did not even start to count black population until like late 1800s. Isn't that gut-wrenching? I couldn't believe that, but I believed it. But I went, I didn't even consider that, and that makes sense. Yeah. But I was stunned, and then that comes in a place in the book where you talk about dead naming, which is referring to somebody's birth name when they have already chosen another. Mm-hmm. Tell us about dead naming, because it's arrogant and it's ignorant, but sometimes it's hostile. Tell us about it.
Yeah. Most of the, thankfully I use the same name I was born with. I don't have an experience of dead naming, but you know, a lot of my friends have experienced that. And, it is very heartbreaking. And a lot of times it's used out of malice. It's used to be mean. And, you know, and to say that when people use your name that you're born with, they are, you know, purposefully choosing not to accept your identity, which is very unfair. And even when somebody has a nickname, you know, we call them by their nickname, but so why can't we call them somebody by their chosen name? Same exactly. example, you know, we do it, but when it comes to the context of transgender people, non-binary people, a lot of people choose to ignore it.
Yeah. And it's disrespectful. And, but the people who tend to dole out that disrespect are kind of consummately disrespectful in general mm-hmm. for all kinds. It's the kind of person that's always going to be that way in those kind of situations, which are foreign to him or her. You know, so that is, or them, are they? I don't think I think some of it is ignorance and the Southern thing. It's, oh, it's not polite. That's how they were called at birth. I can hear the voices of the, I don't want to malign any religion, but it's the Southern Baptist ladies. Oh, it's not polite. And like, oh, bless their heart. And they're thinking, yeah, bless their heart. Bless their hellbound hearts, what they really think. So it is, I find that just in another moving target. I think it's a cultural shift that's happening, and people like you are helping it along. And your book is definitely going to be a piece, an important piece of that. I think it's going to be used in all kinds of studies, LGBT. This is the channel that this podcast is on, the LGBTQ plus studies out there in academia. This is the kind of book that would be a great companion to the reading list for a lot of courses. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
I definitely hope. Yeah, it serves as an academic resource or something that librarians really want. Yeah. And even the bibliography in the back, I had to pare that down just to make it fit. So if anybody wants to email me with, and I can give them just lists of stuff.
Well, like I said, beautifully done, very thoughtfully done. You really go into the ways to be helpful. You're not just saying this is how this was and good luck. You're actually showing people, telling people how to find out more. It's like a documentary book, a docubook in that regard, but
I like
it's so
that.
Much more. Yeah, it's got a lot going on. Very useful and fun to read because it's a beautifully illustrated book. So it's multi-sensorial. And if you're ever going to do it as one of these days as an animated project, I think it would very much lend itself to that. I would love to see that happen. That would be so much fun.
I'm writing that down.
Okay, good. That would be so much fun to watch. And so I think it would be excellent. I have one more question for you before. We're getting close. We're at 45-minute mark. We can't go beyond an hour. We'll get shot down by the evil people. I wanted to ask you before we go, where are you going next with your work?
Good question. I think I would like to do more historical books, maybe even historical fiction, you know, something maybe not as serious. I mean, I had a lot of fun doing this book and I do take it very seriously and I hope people take it seriously too. But I think more queer themes for sure. I mean, I don't know how to make books that don't have that.
Well, the work is so important. I think our listeners, it's going to have a broad appeal, age groups, gender people. I mean, people who are genderqueer, but also the cis world. There's a lot to learn here. So bravo. I'm not sure which one now works. We're going to have to find a new word for that fits in between.
Bravo.
Bravo. Oh, I love that. Write that down. You said it.
I'm writing it into dictionary.com right now.
Yes. Bravo. I love that. I'll be using that and I'll be attributing it to you. I've had such a good time reading the book and talking with you, Shelby. Congratulations. This is a huge accomplishment. And this is your only first book. I can't wait to see what happens next. That's why I asked you that last question.
Gotcha.
So we're going to have to shut down the conversation for now, but I hope we talk again. There's a lot more to talk about. So thank you for joining us. The book is Queer as All Get Out. 10 People Who've Inspired Me by Shelby Siswell. And it's from the publisher Street Noise Press, which even itself has a cool name. So thank you, everybody, for joining us for this episode. Hope you join us next time. Goodbye, everybody.